DR Power Equipment is the industry leader in field and brush mowers. Their full line of machines are designed to clear acres of tough weeds, woody brush, and saplings up to 3 inches thick, hour after hour, year after year. Just one mow, and you'll agree nothing stops at DR. Visit drpower.com to learn more and shop the sale today.
Talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
As one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auchteroin, Argus, Akoiza.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're looking at one of the most ruthless periods of Oliver Cromwell's life, from the execution of Charles I to his massacres in Ireland, as we debate whether he became a king in all but name and why Britain's first and only republic failed. You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. Tonight's show is on one of the most ruthless periods of Oliver Cromwell's life, from the execution of the king to the brutal campaigns in Ireland and Scotland. Cromwell's rise to supreme power was marked by violence, political cunning, and an unyielding sense of divine purpose. Inspired by the publication of the second volume of Ronald Hutton's acclaimed biography of Cromwell and Alice Hunt's new study of Britain's revolutionary decade, we'll explore how Cromwell navigated civil war and division and how his actions left a lasting bloody legacy. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Professor Ronald Hutton is Professor of History at Bristol University and a leading authority on British and Irish history. His books include The Making of Oliver Cromwell, the first volume of his extended biography of Cromwell, and the second volume has just been published, Oliver Cromwell, Commander-in-Chief, published by Yale University Press. Professor Micheála Shukru is the head of the School of Histories and Humanities at Trinity College Dublin. A leading expert on the Cromwellian conquest of Ireland, he has written extensively on 17th century Irish history. Author of God's Executioner, Oliver Cromwell and the Conquest of Ireland. He's the co-editor of Volume 2 of the Letters, Writings and Speeches of Oliver Cromwell and is part of the wider editorial team. Professor John Morrill is Emeritus Professor of British and Irish History at the University of Cambridge. A renowned scholar on the political, religious, social and cultural history of early modern Britain and Ireland. He's the general editor of that comprehensive multi-volume edition of Cromwell's Recorded Words, published by Oxford University Press, and has long studied the complexities of Cromwell's political and military decisions. Well, you're all very welcome. And later in the show, I'll be talking to Professor Alice Hunt, Professor of Early Modern Literature and History at the University of Southampton, and the author of Republic, Britain's Revolutionary Decade, 1649 to 1660, published by Faber and Faber. You're all very welcome. And Ronald, I might begin with you, and I might begin with where you start the book in May Eve, 1647, because what surprised me was just how vulnerable Cromwell's position was there. It wasn't completely obvious that he would be the dominant political figure, that there was a lot of uncertainty and indeed even some insecurity.
Indeed, yes. The party which had always supported him and which he had supported in Parliament when it won the war was now out of power. A party which had always been doubtful about him and about which he had been doubtful was ruling the roost. And when a big military job came up, which was to reconquer Ireland, he was passed over. He's looking like yesterday's man.
And Ronald, you do have some wonderful lines in the book, and I just want to quote some there because, and this is when he's talking about Ireland, and we'll get to Ireland shortly, but I just wonder in terms of contextualising Cromwell and his character, you say he was remaining perfectly true to his nature because he had always been a killer. And then you go on to say he was a born holy warrior and Drogheda was a perfect killing field for him. Now, we will be talking about Drogheda and Wexford and all of that, but it gives us an insight, I think, into the character of Cromwell, doesn't it?
I hope so. I'm not suggesting that Cromwell was a psychopath. He was a highly intelligent man and an extremely capable soldier and politician. he was not going to let bloodlust overrule any other considerations. But he also had a ferocious temper, a tendency to see the world as divided to the followers of God and the followers of Satan. And when both of them came together, things could get quite nasty.
And it's interesting, he came across as more of a politician in the book than I've previously thought of Cromwell. He's having to deal with Parliament, he's having to deal with the army, he's having to deal with the king as well. And it kind of maybe surprised me that when he had all of these challenges, just the way he kind of almost reluctantly hit upon that solution then of executing Charles I, that it certainly wasn't inevitable in 1647 or 1648.
It's not inevitable in 1647, when in fact Cromwell is working quite hard to get a deal with the king himself to obtain his aims and those of his party. It's getting a lot more inevitable in 1648, once the Scots invade and the provinces rise on behalf of the imprisoned king. And pretty well from April onwards, the army decides that if they survive, they're going to call the king to account.
And John, I'll bring you in on that, because that is then the crucial turning point, January 1649, and the execution of Charles I. And how shocking an event was that in terms of the history of these islands?
Well, it was completely shocking. I mean, one starts, I think, by the fact that several observers of the scene said that as Charles I's head came off, this crowd you'd come to see it, there was a moan the like of which I never wish to hear again. I mean, it was an unthinkable act. I mean, one of the fascinating things I think is that if you chop off the king's head, the unthinkables happened, and then unthinkable things can be thought. I mean, all kinds of other radical ideas are made possible because this unthinkable thing had happened. But you're absolutely right that although there are people towards the end of 1647 who are beginning to call for justice on the king, which implies his death, Cromwell is very slow to pick up on that. Cromwell is convinced by the end of 1647 that the king must go, but that is by deposition rather than by execution. It takes a long time for him to believe that God wants the king to be executed and for him to think that it's necessary for the king to be executed. So that is a very much a last minute decision, particularly for Cromwell. Others had it in their mind for a longer period.
And Ronald, there are these kind of maybe contradictions in the character that emerges, because at times he is ruthless, at times he is devious, but then at other times he's justifying everything in his own head and in what he says by the will of God. So there definitely seems to be a trade-off there in how he's even justifying things in his own head.
Well, Cromwell can ultimately justify virtually anything that seems right to him as the will of God. And this is because there is a completely seamless union between Cromwell's sense of waiting to see what God wants and then helping it to happen, and Cromwell's sense of the way things are going in practical politics and what is almost inevitably going to happen, especially within his own party and among the people supporting his ideals. So it's really a completely united blend for him. There's never a tension between his religion and his political instincts.
Michal, we're revisiting the subject of Oliver Cromwell tonight because it's in part because of the publication of Ronald's new book. It's in part because whenever we do a show on Cromwell, it is our most downloaded show, which shows the level of interest in him. I suppose the way his name still triggers a very strong response.
Absolutely. And I think that the ongoing interest in Cromwell on both sides of the Irish Sea is really quite extraordinary. But as you say, here in Ireland in particular, he remains the bugbear, if you like, of Irish history. He remains the name that probably more than any other triggers a lot of emotions in people, and a lot of the ills of English rule here in Ireland are laid at his doorstep, whether fairly or not, but that's just how it has unfolded over the last couple of centuries.
And how much of that is deserved? Because it goes into this crucial part of the visit to Ireland. It's chapter 6 in Ronald's book, and you have the events in Drogheda, and you have the events in Wexford and so on. And how much of it is the heat of the moment where Cromwell decides that he kind of almost loses control of what's happening? How much of it is deliberate and it's a punishment? How much of it is God's will? Because you do see Cromwell kind of justifying things in different ways or trying to explain things away in different ways.
No, absolutely. And I agree with Ronald, by the way, when he says Cromwell's not a psychopath, and absolutely not. He's a very considered man in lots of ways. I disagree very strongly with Ronald, I have to say, when he says that he's not going to allow bloodlust, you know, lose the run of himself. He clearly does in Ireland. And I think what happens in Ireland is so contrary to what is expected and accepted in England. And Cromwell isn't unusual, Patrick, in this. I mean, we've had a century of conquest, violent, bloody conquest in Ireland, where the normal rules simply do not apply. And it turns genocidal in the 1650s. And Cromwell's name is associated with that, and quite correctly, in my opinion.
Ronald, what's fascinating in your book is that the sense to which Cromwell was aware of how this could damage his reputation. After Drogheda, after Wexford, he's putting his own spin on things, he's sending back his own justifications, and he is very much aware that this could damage him.
He certainly is. And actually, the only thing I disagree about with Micheál is his assertion that he disagrees fundamentally with me. He doesn't. Because what I am saying about Cromwell is Cromwell does keep bloodlust and a foul temper in check some of the time. But when he feels able to let it rip, terrible things happen. I'd only play down Micheál's contrast with England. Certainly the violence, the horror in Ireland in the 1640s and 1650s is out of all proportion to what happens in England. But Cromwell's behavior in England, although much more muted than in Ireland, is still pretty bloodthirsty. When he wins his first action, which is a local skirmish in Lincolnshire in 1643. When he writes the report, he exults about the way his men pursued the fleeing royalists for 6 miles, doing execution on them. That is, killing as many as they can. In his next skirmish, a well-known royalist commander, a nobleman, is knocked off his horse when the royalists are running again. And he's a perfect character for ransom or exchange as a prisoner. Instead, Cromwell exults about the way in which his second in command runs the man under the short ribs with his sword and kills him when he's lying helpless on the ground. And it kind of goes on like that. That's why I say Cromwell manipulates and restrains bloodshed when he thinks it will do him credit to do so. But when he's able to do so, he is a killer, and he is a killer at Drogheda.
And maybe just to explain to our listeners what exactly happened at Drogheda. You had the storming of Drogheda, and then various debates about how much of the garrison were killed afterwards, how many were deliberately murdered, whether any unarmed civilians were deliberately murdered, and that became a lot of the controversial debate afterwards.
Okay. In my painfully conciliatory fashion, I'm going to try and establish the thing on which every sensible historian agrees. We all agree that when Cromwell broke into the town, the vast majority of the enormous royalist garrison were slaughtered. Very few of them got away. Now, there had been other massacres in Ireland, but the sheer size of the garrison at Drogheda meant that the body count was astronomical, out of all proportion to anything else in Britain or Ireland in the mid-17th century. And similarly, there's also an agreement among historians that the majority of the civilian population of Drogheda seems to have survived. Now, this is important because there was a very powerful belief in Ireland until recently that Cromwell had ordered the killing of every man, woman, and child in the place. So there's been a lot of reaction against this myth and a lot of agreement now on the extent of the slaughter. What's still in dispute, because the sources ultimately are not absolutely certain on this, is whether any women and children were killed, whether any civilians were killed who weren't carrying weapons or were thought to be carrying weapons. I go with the majority in thinking that women and children were killed and that males who weren't carrying weapons or thought to be were killed as well. And probably in some number, but that's very hard to prove.
And Ronald, my sense is that Cromwell, because Cromwell was worried about how this would affect his reputation and he's putting his own interpretation on it in messages back to England, that makes me feel that he knew himself that he had gone too far there.
I totally agree with that. Every time Cromwell wins a crushing victory, except now, he immediately sends a triumphant dispatch back home, bigging up the extent of his success as greatly as possible. Drogheda, uniquely, results in a media blackout by Cromwell and his commanders. They're clearly spending a couple of weeks trying to work out how to package what they've done, and then they do it quite effectively.
Micheál, Ronald has been very good there in explaining where there is agreement amongst historians on Drogheda. Where is there not agreement?
No, I think Ronald has outlined very effectively, I have to say, in a very balanced way, where current scholarship and current thinking lies with regards to Drogheda. But if I may, I suppose, as Ronald himself pointed out, there is perhaps a difference between us on a matter of degree, because I think the degree is so enormous and the scale of the killing in Ireland is so huge that really we are looking at something fundamentally different. And I think rather than comparisons with England, where there were some killings, but nothing on the scale, as Ronald has pointed out, on what happened in Ireland, I think we have to start looking at this more on a colonial scale and in context of the Atlantic world and what's going on with European expansion throughout the Atlantic world this time and when they encounter indigenous peoples. And we see the same pattern occurring in the Americas, in the Caribbean, in South America and in Ireland. That, as I said before, that the rules simply do not apply. So the norms that we'd expect in Europe simply are not relevant to the conflict in Ireland, as they're not relevant to the conflict in new emerging colonies elsewhere in the Atlantic world. And that's what allows the killings on these absolutely astronomical scale to take place. So I think rather than getting into the minutiae of trying to work out exactly numbers, be it in Drogheda or elsewhere, I think what we see is warfare of a fundamental different nature and on a scale that would be simply unthinkable and unacceptable in England or indeed elsewhere in Europe.
And is the hatred because they are Catholic? Is it because they are Irish? Or is it just that they're seen as beneath them and that they're going to be exterminated the way you might see similarly with other colonial misadventures in the years ahead?
I think it's a combination of factors. I think that the trope of the savage Irish is one that goes back, as we know, to the 12th century and lasts for right the way through until the 17th century. So this isn't something new. And Cromwell, as I've said, is not the only proponent of this. This is a long history in Ireland. And I think from the middle 16th century onwards, we're getting, if you like, a unique combination of ethno-religious factors here. So the Irish are not only savage and outside of civilized norms, but also as Catholics, there therefore there's a sectarian hatred as well, and it's that combination, I think, that proves particularly deadly in an Irish context.
John, how much is it Cromwell's responsibility? How much was it forces beyond his control? How much was it a sense of wanting revenge for what was perceived to have happened in 1641 with an attempted massacre of the Protestants in Ireland? How much of it was to do with just just kind of these kind of military atrocities that you often see in similar situations? How much of it is this anti or this colonial mindset that Michal has been describing?
I go much further than I used to do, along with the way Michal's talking. There is that dimension. I mean, I think there is a coarsening effect of anyone who's involved in war year after year. You can see the coarsening effect on Cromwell over previous years. And of course, there's been a, in terms of proportionally, a similar sort of level of massacre by Cromwell in Hampshire in 1645 at Basing House. But I mean, it is, you're quite right that what happens at Drogheda is off the scale, but it is the one time it's done. I'm not sure that Cromwell's worried about reputational damage, and it didn't cause him any reputational damage. The fact is that the House of Commons, you know, celebrated his victory. There was no public outcry at all. I think what's going on here is that Cromwell is trying in his letters home to say something very important, which is, I need the level of resources that you're giving me. I'm going to need those in order to finish this task. He's terrified that there will be war weariness. The politicians will get tired of all the taxation they're pouring into Ireland. And he's trying to make clear this is a very bloody war and he needs the resources. The other thing I think is very, the two things are important to say. One is that he makes it pretty clear that much of his anger is directed against royalists, not against Catholics. It isn't specifically a Catholic massacre or a massacre of those who are responsible for 1641. The heads he displays at Dublin are mainly of English heads, of people starting the war all over again, having lost it in England, that his enemies in Ireland are predominantly the royalists who are going to try and put the king back on the throne. Having said all that, he undoubtedly has been saturated in all propaganda about the massacres of 1641. And we must never forget that a major purpose of his coming to Ireland is to make good the claims of those who'd already invested very heavily in the war to protect the Protestant community back in the early 40s, and who are now demanding the 25% of the land of Ireland that they'd been promised in return for their investment. Now, these people were now really clamouring for their money back, and what's more, they were still the people who were lending money to the state. So Cromwell has an absolute obligation to make this war a successful war, so that the people who control the credit lines in London can get their money for the investments they'd made back in the 40s. Very complicated situation. But I don't think Cromwell is at all worried about reputational risk, although I do think he committed something which by any stretch of the imagination and a contemporary understanding was a war crime, because he overruled a junior officer who had granted mercy to the defenders of the Mill Mount, and he'd overruled them and said, I said that no one in arms was to be spared. And to overrule a junior officer is something which caused a major disagreement between himself and Henry Ireton, who subsequently published a pamphlet in which he criticised senior officers who overruled junior officers and besmirched the honour of the army, when the same thing happened at Limerick. And he published it in London, knowing that that was a direct attack on his father-in-law, Oliver Cromwell. So there is a great deal of squeamishness about what happened at Drogheda, but a lot of it has to do with internal tensions in the army about the right conduct.
And then, Michal, we have the sack of Wexford in October of that year, 1649. And again, that's a huge part of the charge sheet against Cromwell.
No, absolutely. And John points out in many of his works earlier on, Drogheda isn't a one-off. And he makes a very interesting comparison with what happens at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, in a sense of the use of terror in an extreme way in order to subdue the enemy, demoralize them. And what we have within a few weeks of Drogheda is a second massacre, of course, at Wexford, where more or less the same things happens, if slightly different scenario in terms of how it unfolds, but the end result is the same. But I think, again, what I would just point out is that whatever happens in these early stages of the war is what happens over the next 3 or 4 years is actually what's really crucial here, because this, as I've written about, is a genocidal conflict. The scale of the killing and of the loss and the depopulation in Ireland is really quite extraordinary, and anywhere from 20 to 40%, depending on which sources you look at. And really, that is something that Cromwell, even though he's not in Ireland at the time, is the commander-in-chief, and by the mid-1650s is the head of state, and therefore, in my view, is directly culpable for this, even if he's not in the country himself at the time.
And what goes wrong in Wexford? Is it just the same again happening? Is it because you have a similar massacre of people there?
No, I think what we have at Wexford is there are negotiations ongoing for the surrender of the town. And during those negotiations, a number of troops, of Cromwell's troops, are admitted into the town. And then they manage to open the gates for all the besieging forces to enter. And so a massacre begins. So Cromwell isn't directly aware of this at first, but what happens is very quickly the garrison, again quite a considerable garrison, is slaughtered with an indeterminate number of civilians. So it's quite a similar outcome, even though the events leading up to it are slightly different.
And Ronald, that very powerful phrase that you have in the book, you describe Cromwell as a born holy warrior. You refer to Drogheda as a perfect killing field for him, populated by a beaten foe who represented both a cause and a religion that he detested and regarded as ungodly. But that idea of the born holy warrior really struck me, because that shows someone who is certainly much more extreme than the devious, conniving, somewhat insecure political figure of the earlier chapters.
Yes, but that's because Cromwell's back in action in war. And so he's actually able to kill the people he thinks are God's enemies, instead of having to find gentler ways of dealing with them. And with regard to Wexford, where that comes through, for once, I'm actually going to be harsher on Cromwell than Micheál just was, because he violated a convention of war at Wexford that made that massacre possible. And the convention he violates is that when your enemy is negotiating for surrender, you stop attacking him. At Wexford, Cromwell ordered the assault on the town to keep going, even when he was allowing the people inside to negotiate a surrender. Now, that could be because he suspected them, as they'd done once before, inside of breaking off peace talks. But nonetheless, it resulted in a situation whereby the commander inside lost attention, and so the attack was able to get into the city and the massacre occur. And had Cromwell been more honourable in that context and less ruthlessly pragmatic, it wouldn't have happened. The town would have been able to surrender.
Well, we're talking history, and tonight we are talking about the life and indeed legacy of Oliver Cromwell. We're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, I'll be talking to Professor Alice Hunt about Britain's first and indeed only republic, Cromwell's crucial role in it, and whether he was a king in all but name. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history as we continue our debate on Oliver Cromwell, and I'm delighted to be joined by Professor Alice Hunt, Professor of Early Modern Literature and History at the University of Southampton, and the author of a brilliant new book, Republic, Britain's Revolutionary Decade, 1649 to 1660, just published in hardback by Faber and Faber. Alice, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
It's a fascinating period. England's first and only republic, as you say in your epilogue. And the character of Oliver Cromwell really is central to that, isn't he?
He is central, and he becomes increasingly central. He's not the most important person at the beginning of the republic. He's second in command of the new model army, working under Sir Thomas Fairfax. But as he leads these extraordinary victories and controversial victories in Ireland and then in Scotland, he becomes the kind of hero, military hero, and is given more recognition and power by the Republic until he then is made Lord Protector at the end of 1653. The Republican experiment that's been put in place since the execution of the king has fallen apart. And in its place, they come up with the idea of a protectorate, and Cromwell becomes head of state.
And some people see him as kind of a king in all but name. Do you think that's fair on Cromwell, or is that one of the myths that have developed around him?
I think this is one of the misconceptions of Cromwell, that really he was just like a king, that the protectorate was just like a monarchy, and that the republic as a whole, the whole decade, was kind of sliding back towards monarchy, and that this is a justification for the restoration of the monarchy, because really it was just like a monarchy anyway, and that's what England really wanted, what it really was. It wasn't suited to being a republic. But I think this misses the differences between Cromwell and the monarchy. He was a commoner. He had absolutely no royal blood in him at all. He was ambitious and he was ruthless, but he did not want to be king. And when he was offered the crown in 1657, this is an attempt to stabilize the country, to settle the constitution, for it to be recognized as legitimate. He's offered the crown and the title of king, and he refuses it. But he's refusing a title that he thinks God himself has blasted. The victories on the battlefield for him were in God's name. They were God's victories. It was Providence that was leading this and declaring against the king. He cannot, in his conscience, accept the title of king. And the title is also not exactly of king, is not really what we would recognize as king. There's a written constitution they want, which would define his powers. It wouldn't be hereditary. It would be nominated. This is a kingship with a difference. There was no coronation. There was a ceremony. But there was no anointing of the monarch. There was no understanding this was a sacred office at all. So this is a really quite new understanding of a head of state with perhaps the title of king. But he refuses it anyway. He does not want it.
And it's fascinating the way you say there about God's victories. And that is something that features so much in studies of Cromwell and in your book, that the idea that God is on their side, that this is God's will, that the events that we see in Drogheda and Wexford, this is God's will being done, and punishment for those who have crossed it. And it is very powerful in this period.
It's really powerful. And I think we have to take it seriously. We have I think it's one of the aspects of the period that is so distant, makes it so distant and difficult for us to understand, that this powerful providential logic and belief that God is on their side, it's not an excuse to behave in a particular way or to go to war. I think that it's sincerely held, and particularly by a figure such as Cromwell. There's so much in 1650s that I think feels close to us in some ways. The arguments about liberty, sovereignty, whether we should have a bicameral parliament or two, you know, single chamber, two chambers, a House of Lords, not a House of Lords. What is the prerogative of a head of state? What is a republic? All of these questions about the people, and it feels so pertinent to us. At the same time, there's this providential logic and reasoning, which I think is hard for us to understand. And this fueled Cromwell and many of the soldiers that were fighting with him as well.
And you do talk about how you mention the name of Cromwell, and people in Ireland still talk about the curse of Cromwell. And you might have you might find these very strong emotions and very strong feelings about him. How do you view that period in Ireland? And then when you're talking about the wider republic, how does that maybe taint it, or does it cast a shadow over the republic?
Yes, it does. I don't think what happened to Ireland can ever be forgotten, and the blame is in the Republic, and a lot of it with Cromwell, not only with Cromwell. Once he'd left Ireland in 1650 and was preparing to move to Scotland and fight there, the redistribution of the land and what happened to Irish Catholics and being evicted from their homes and their property being disbanded, that is with the English Parliament. Cromwell certainly has to be responsible for the deaths. They've been called massacres at Drogheda and Wexford. He was leading the troops, And he does say in one letter that he was in the heat of action, and civilians were caught up in battles, and the early modern terms of warfare, which should have been adhered to, were not, giving quarter or sparing soldiers who had surrendered or who weren't carrying arms. It does cast a shadow. We have to accept the belief, the principles that lay behind wanting to reconquer Ireland were shared by many in England, that the Irish were Papist rebels, bloodthirsty rebels, terrible stories that were circulating around their behaviour, wildly exaggerated, but which seemed to justify the attitude towards fighting them and bringing them in, wanting to convert them, wanting to exert Protestantism. These were religious wars.
Well, my thanks to Professor Alice Hunt, Professor of Early Modern and Literature and History at the University of Southampton, for joining us for this part of the discussion. She's the author of a brilliant new book, Republic, Britain's Revolutionary Decades, 1649 to 1660. We are going to have her back in a few weeks' time to talk about the book, because there's so much that we want to go into about this brilliant new study. But Alice, thanks so much for joining our Cromwell discussion.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.
We'll be back with more debating the life and indeed the legacy of Cromwell right after this. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are talking about the life and legacy of Oliver Cromwell. I'm rejoined by my brilliant panel of experts, Professor Ronald Hutton, Professor of History at Bristol University and a leading authority on British and Irish history. His new book is Oliver Cromwell, Commander-in-Chief. It's just been published by Yale University Press. The earlier volume was The Making of Oliver Cromwell, and he's a leading expert on the 16th and 17th centuries. Also rejoined by Professor Mihola Shukru, the head of the School of History and Humanities at Trinity College Dublin, a leading expert on the Cromwellian conquest of Ireland. He's written extensively on 17th century Irish history and is the author of God's Executioner, Oliver Cromwell and the Conquest of Ireland. He's the co-editor of Volume 2 of the Letters, Writings and Speeches of Oliver Cromwell and part of the wider editorial team. Professor John Morrill also rejoins us, Emeritus Professor of British and Irish History at the University of Cambridge, a renowned scholar on the political, religious, social and cultural history of early modern Britain and Ireland. He's the general editor of that comprehensive multi-volume edition of Cromwell's Recorded Words, published by Oxford University Press, and has long studied the complexities of Cromwell's political and military decisions. And earlier there, we were joined by Professor Alice Hunt. And John, I wanted to ask you about Cromwell's reputation and about how he has been such a hero to some in England, not to all, but certainly a hero to some, and then a viewed as a hate figure by others in England, in Scotland, in Wales, and of course in Ireland.
Yeah, he was at a low point from fairly early in the Restoration, when the defeated party, the Protectoral Party, wanted to see him as the traitor who'd let down the revolution. I mean, a bit like Napoleon after his downfall. And of course, the Royalists loathed him. So there was nothing but odium and silence. I mean, people were either silent about him or right through the 18th century. And then he comes back in a big way in the 19th century, particularly through the work of Thomas Carlyle, who produced the first edition of his words, and who saw him as a man who bestrode his age, a man who lived out liberal values of overthrowing tyranny in all its forms. And his deeply influential edition made him a hero, particularly to religious nonconformists, Protestant nonconformists, a hero, and to the working class, and to the movement for democratization. And there's a huge amount of creative thinking goes into that. But from that point onwards, he becomes someone who I think probably has a majority positive image in Britain, but not, of course, ever in Ireland, except, I suppose, amongst Ulster Protestants. And that carries on so that by the year 2000, for example, when Radio 4 in Britain had a poll of the greatest ever Britons, he came third. And when the television imitated, did another Great Britons of the past millennium, he got into the top 10. People couldn't vote against him, but they could vote for him. And he was more popular than almost anybody except one or two, Shakespeare, obviously, Elizabeth I, obviously, Victoria. I mean, he's right up there. And he's remained pretty popular. He dies and there are huge crowds silent crowds, but huge crowds watching his funeral cortege make its way to Westminster Abbey. 2 years later, or 3 years later, there are quite large crowds seeing him being hanged in his shroud and cut into quarters, and his body thrown into a lime pit, and his head going off to be a fairground exhibit. So from the very beginning, he's been one of the most controversial figures in British history. Whether he's been seen predominantly in mainland Britain as a good thing or a bad thing has varied over time.
And Ronald, you have a line in your book that again struck me. You say, "The actions of Cromwell and his soldiers after they entered Drogheda represent the greatest single stain on his historical reputation, and the question of how deep a stain that should be has been debated for over 100 years. And when I read that, I thought, well, wait, surely it should be, you know, 350 or almost 400 years. But you show how really some of these debates became 19th century debates, as John has said. And it's really in that last period, the most recent period, where in a way people re-engaged with the controversies about Cromwell.
Yes, we're all at the mercy of the Victorians whenever it comes to the writing of history, or indeed prehistory. It's because the mid-19th century British, and above all the English, took up Cromwell as one of their greatest national heroes. That then put him so thoroughly on the map that Irish nationalists began reacting to him. And what was an already established view of Cromwell as a bogey, but one bogey among various others, elevated him to the greatest hate figure in Irish history. So it's a kind of dialectic between British and Irish from the 1840s onwards that gives us both the good and the bad Cromwell. And throughout my career, and my main difference as a historian from Micheál and John is that I'm much greedier and more reckless in the domain that I've taken for the writing of history. I've written about an awful lot of different kinds of history and attitudes to prehistory. But all of them really consist of doing a renovation and revision job on the Victorians and the Edwardians, checking these great foundational histories, going back to the sources and seeing which of the foundations of the 20th century orthodoxies of history are sound and which of them are rotten.
And Ronald, how have people responded to your book, or if you're speaking at events about Cromwell, how do they respond in Britain to hearing about events in Ireland? Does it change how they view Cromwell, or is there a kind of an indifference or an ignorance about Ireland that unfortunately we see with things like the aftermath of Brexit and so on, where there isn't really a kind of a knowledge of or an understanding of things on this island?
Indifference and ignorance reign on this side of the water regarding all things Irish. It's a constant pain to me because I was born a colonial myself out in India. And so I was brought up to regard the Irish, the Scots, the Welsh and the English as a sisterhood and brotherhood who had combined to create this incredibly successful, if short-lived, phenomenon called the British Empire. And so I was brought up to regard characters like Finn McCool and Cuchulainn as my heroes as much as those on this side of the water. And then I arrived back in England and found a breathtaking ignorance, disdain, and amnesia regarding all things Irish, against which I've been banging my head in Britain ever since.
And Ronald, you also then talk about the campaigns in Scotland, and that's very interesting. And does he treat the inhabitants differently in Scotland than he did in Ireland?
He does to an extent, because the Scots were former allies. In fact, they were invaluable allies. Without their intervention, it's probable that Cromwell's side would not have won the English Civil War. But Cromwell also sees them as apostates who've gone over to the dark side. And in terms of his actual warfare, he is gentler, but that's largely because he is not storming large garrisons as he's doing in Ireland. Only small garrisons get stormed, and when they're stormed, he orders them to be slaughtered. Now, we're only dealing with a few score people instead of thousands, but the savagery is the same. And when his lieutenant, he leaves in Scotland, George Monk, storms Dundee in 1651. He slaughters the garrison, 700 soldiers are killed, and the place is comprehensively looted. Some civilians die as well. And that there isn't more of that is just because there's not more storming of towns. So there is a difference in degree, but I don't see it as being an absolutely wholesale one, i.e. slaughter the Irish but spare the English and the Scots.
And Micheál, that is fascinating, the fact that if you had had something similar to Drogheda in Scotland or in England, he probably would be viewed differently, but there is that blind spot when it comes to Irish history in Britain.
There is, and I think both John and Ronald have sort of covered, if you like, the historical legacy since Cromwell's death in the mid-17th century. But I would argue that, in essence, really, we're looking in the wrong place, because Cromwell's lasting legacy in Ireland is not about Drogheda and Wexford and the arguments and debates we have about that, but actually in the settlement that comes after the war, because that is what radically transforms Ireland. It turns it into effectively a colony for huge exploitation. The land is massively transferred. The economic motivations for this invasion probably outweighed all others, that merchant adventurers need to be repaid. The army hadn't been paid in years, needed to be paid off. And so this led to a scale of lands transfer that was unknown anywhere else, certainly in Western Europe at this time, and creates a Protestant ascendancy that really dominates Irish political, social, economic life from then until the great land reforms of the late 19th century. And that's why Cromwell survives as this figure of hatred and of fear, etc., because of this long-lasting legacy. As Ronald points out, there were many slaughters and massacres in Ireland by people whose names are long forgotten, except to a handful of historians. But it's a Cromwellian settlement that follows the war that brings about this lasting impact of Cromwell's legacy and why he remains this figure of hate to this day.
Because it's a conquest that's reshaping Ireland politically and socially. It's creating divisions that, as you say, last for centuries. Land becomes the huge grievance. It's a way of showing who has power and who doesn't, and who has wealth and who doesn't. And it creates the tensions that scar Ireland for centuries later.
Absolutely. And one of the things I thought was absolutely fascinating is that in the Folklore Archive, which is in UCD here in Dublin, the two biggest characters by far who are mentioned more than any others by a long, long way. One is Daniel O'Connell and the other is Oliver Cromwell. And so right down to the level of folklore and local storytelling, etc., we get this name that Cromwell is there. And because people are living on the land, people are living on land that they see, as they believe, has been unjustly taken from them. And the person who they lay the blame on the door of is, of course, Oliver Cromwell.
Ronald, what about then the rest of the period that you cover in your book, the other campaigns and his attempts to, I suppose, create this Commonwealth and to establish these principles that are going to then govern Britain for the 1650s? How successful is he in constructing this new order?
He's a complete failure. That's why the Republic crumbles. There was a fundamental flaw lying at the bottom of the settlements attempted by Cromwell and his allies, and that was that the vast majority of the English, let alone the Welsh, the Scots, and the Irish, didn't want Cromwell and his people to be in charge and didn't want what they represented. They really did want a national church which was based on ceremony and beauty as well as upon preaching and the Bible. They wanted a national church which had the allegiance, willing or not, of the majority, the overwhelming majority of the inhabitants, preferably all of them. And they wanted a political settlement in which the three estates of the realm, that's a kingly figure, and lords and commons were represented. And therefore, because Cromwell and his people stood for fundamentally different principles from the majority of the English, I say, let alone the other nations, they were people who talked democracy but were profoundly undemocratic. They spoke of religious toleration, but what they really meant was toleration for the godly, which means them and those who supported them. So sooner or later, it was going to crack because it didn't have the foundations to last.
And it does seem like a huge failure, a huge blot for the Republic that it does end in 1660. You do have the Restoration that, after going to such lengths to remove the monarchy and the execution of Charles I, to just bring back Charles II, you know, just a decade and a year later, it just seems like a monumental failure.
It does, but the Cromwellian period did change certain things for good. Micheál spoken for Ireland. In Britain, it ensured that Parliament was now a permanent part of government, and kings who wanted to strengthen their power needed to do so by taking Parliament over as opposed to scrapping it. It ensured that a large number of people utterly refused to worship inside the Church of England as it was brought back in the 1660s. Making us one of the most diverse societies in terms of religion and culture in Europe, and charting a course towards the sort of country which I'm kind of pleased to live in today. And it also taught the Irish and the Scots that the English without kings were even more dangerous than the English with kings, and thereby made the Highland Scots and the Irish more inclined than before to support the Stuarts. The one thing that Micheál said about Cromwell's effect, which I would slightly alter, is that the permanence was partly a trick of history, because Cromwell's settlement was overturned in 1688, and the war that finished Ireland was not really that of the 1640s and 50s, but that of the early 1690s. And the old Ireland finally died on the battlefields of the Boyne and Ochrim. And the course of Irish history set by Cromwell was made definite as a result of the defeat of the Irish and the Jacobite royalists.
John, I think we always find new things to say because there is all this new extraordinary scholarship being done, and the incredible work you've been doing leading that editorial project with Oxford University, publishing the writings and the speeches and the letters of Cromwell. We are all the time getting new insights into both Cromwell and this period of history.
Yes, I mean, the 1660 isn't the end. It's a pause in a process that goes through really, in what some ways, down to 1746 and Culloden and the final defeat of Jacobitism and the consolidation then of an English hegemony across the three kingdoms with all the things that go with it. For me, the great problem is that if you blame Cromwell so much, you let a lot of English off the hook. There are a lot of people worse than Cromwell in terms of their attitudes to Ireland. So I think we've got to be careful that in placing all the blame on Cromwell, we don't place the blame much more broadly on English colonial attitudes, which are still with us.
And Micheál, I might leave the final word with you that in a way, going on what you were talking about, we need to go beyond Cromwell, we need to go beyond Drogheda and see this in terms of the land settlement and see this in terms of colonialism and see this in terms of a complete restructuring of Ireland.
Oh, absolutely. We have to remember that there was a very conscious effort in 1660, both in England and in Scotland, to turn the clock back as if none of this had ever happened. Let's just pretend this was just an aberration and move on. We've got the restored monarchy and we'll try and reshape. There were changes, but nothing quite as very dramatic. In Ireland, there's no turn the clock back. And that's why Cromwell survives here, perhaps in a way and in different ways to we see in England, because the clock wasn't turned back and we're living with the legacy ever since.
Well, my thanks to my brilliant panel of experts for talking to me tonight about the life and legacy of Oliver Cromwell. Professor Ronald Hutton of Bristol University, whose new book is Oliver Cromwell, Commander-in-Chief, published by Yale University Press. Professor Micheál Aşukru, the head of the School of Histories and Humanities at Trinity College Dublin. Professor John Morrill of the University of Cambridge. And earlier in the show, we also were joined by Professor Alice Hunt of the University of Southampton, whose new book is Republic, Britain's Revolutionary Decade. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer Marisa Sullivan and Peter Malloy on sound. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.